It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss emerging issues in open government as some police departments use a law designed to shield the identity of crime victims, applying it to hide the names of officers who were involved in shootings. Be part of this discussion on access to public information. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bill Leaders is an investigative journalist and president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Bill, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good to be here.
Good morning. Starting with the Oshkosh Police Department withholding the name of an officer who shot and wounded a man in June as its legal justification. Murphy's Law, right? The agency citing a recent amendment to the state constitution known as Murphy's Law. What is your reaction to the reasoning for withholding the name of an officer?
Well, I think it's an incorrect and actually an abusive interpretation of the Murphy's Law constitutional amendment to say that the names of victims can never be disclosed. And including cases where the victims, in this case, are the police officers who shot a suspect. He apparently or allegedly pointed a weapon at them in a suicidal moment, and they are considered victims by this interpretation of Murphy's Law. And so the name of the officer who shot them and some of the other officers who were involved in this situation have not been publicly disclosed. This is troubling. I don't think it's what Murphy's Law was intended to do. It's not the first time that Murphy's Law has been applied on behalf of victims in a way that we found questionable and objectionable. It probably won't be the last.
So having a gun pointed at officers or an officer is justification for Murphy's Law protection, while the person who an officer shot, their name is published.
Yes, the name of the individual who was shot by Oshkosh police was made public, and the names of the officers were not.
Let's step back to look at Murphy's Law in 2020. It was touted to voters as a constitutional amendment to protect the privacy of crime victims. In Wisconsin and several other states, how is Murphy's Law being used to limit public transparency in police shootings?
Well, this story was done by Wisconsin Watch. By Jacob Resnick of Wisconsin Watch just last week. He wrote about the Oshkosh case, and he wrote about other states in which this issue has come up. In Columbus, Ohio, they've also cited Murphy's Law, which passed in that state as a constitutional amendment, as a reason not to disclose the names of officers who are involved in shootings because they're victims. And there are other states and cities that have refused to release this information of the names of officers who were involved in shootings for other reasons, not just Murphy's Law, but for other justifications. They say that these names are not going to be released. Sometimes they're not released immediately, but they're released eventually. And the article in Wisconsin Watch talks about a number of situations in Wisconsin in which the names of officers have either been promptly released or never released or released right away.
The State Justice Department in 2021 issued an advisory outlining how authorities should balance requests for government records with the strengthened privacy requirements for crime victims. Does that advisory help clarify what can be released to the public?
Well, it's a very detailed document. It's several pages long, and it gives some hypothetical scenarios and gives some advice. But ultimately, what the Department of Justice advisory says about Murphy's Law is that each situation needs to be considered individually, that the facts of the situation have to be taken into account on a one-by-one basis. So every time it comes up, they have to apply an analysis. This decision was prompted by some really deep confusion about what the law was supposed to do. There was a sheriff in Dodge County who was withholding the names of businesses that were victims of crime. So I'll give you the hypothetical. Say a Target store is robbed. The police report would not release the name of the store that was the victim of the robbery because it was a victim. That was the way Murphy's Law was being interpreted in that case. And the Justice Department tried to bring a little bit of sanity and perspective to these analysis, but it still is up to police departments to apply a balance each and every time this comes up and decide whether a name will be released. I'll tell you this, for myself, If somebody shoots me, I want my name in the paper. I don't want that privacy protection. I don't want the names of victims to be routinely and automatically withheld, and especially in situations where victims are officers of the law and are expected to have a higher level of public accountability.
We're talking about government transparency with Bill Leaders, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. And you can join in the conversation. Call in with a question or a comment at 800-642-1234. Bill, turning to Illinois, you've contrasted how use of force complaints against law enforcement are handled differently in our neighboring state, Illinois, than in Wisconsin. What is the difference?
Well, I only recently became aware of this. I was contacted by an individual with something called the Invisible Project, and I became aware that in Illinois there was a court ruling that declared that use of force complaints against officers needed to be made public, and they have been. And so in Illinois, you can find out automatically information about use of force reports. In fact, for Chicago and for Champaign-Urbana, the group, the Invisibility Project, has compiled a database which you can just go to, type in the name of any police officer, and you'll see the use of force complaints that have come up and some more information about the nature of those complaints and the resolution of those complaints. So it's a very public process there. Contrast that to Wisconsin, where in the situation that I've been writing about, I requested records of a disciplinary investigation. For a very minor matter involving the Madison Police Department, and was told to expect a wait of 14 months for those records to be provided. Now, they were provided to me just a week and a half ago after about 4 months of waiting, which is still too long. And I believe that the delays that are built into the process of providing these records, particularly records that have to do with disciplinary allegations or allegations of misconduct involving officers, need to be provided much more promptly.
Why can the release of government records take months or even over a year?
Well, what's happening, as I understand it, or perhaps misunderstand it, is that the Madison Police Department takes records request on a first come, first serve basis. They put you in line. So if you make a request and they've got a whole bunch more very complicated requests before yours, they're not going to get around to yours until they deal with the much more complicated requests that have been made beforehand. And so it gets pushed way, way down the line. I don't think that's an appropriate application of the law. In fact, I think the law expressly has language which suggests that records need to be provided, that simple requests should be provided quicker than complicated requests, so that they should not be treated as a, pick your number and wait in line type situation, but they should be handled as promptly as possible for each every and every request.
Going back to the 90s, you and other journalists sued the Madison Police Department and established the public's right to records of complaints against police officers. Over the decades, why can these records still be difficult to obtain despite lawsuits?
Yeah, well, that's how I got involved in this whole area of open government as a reporter. It happened because I was looking into complaints against Madison police officers, and I found that it was nearly impossible to obtain information. And so Isthmus, where I worked at the time, and the Wisconsin State Journal, and ultimately the Capital Times, we filed two lawsuits in the mid-1990s against the Madison Police Department, seeking records of complaints against police officers. One of those lawsuits dealt with complaints that were filed by members of the public against officers, and the second complaint, or the second lawsuit, I should say, was brought for records that, of complaints that were filed by officers against other officers, where one officer sees an infraction and reports it. Those generally are much more likely to lead to disciplinary action, these so-called internal complaints. But we won both those lawsuits and supposedly have secured the right of public access to complaints against police. But when recently I saw that there was a disciplinary matter that was brought up for the first 3 months of this year, and I requested the records for it, the response came back, yes, we've received your request, expect to wait 14 months. And that is what started me on trying to push back against the police department of Madison for prompter access to these records.
Just a note here, circling back to the Invisible Institute that had created databases in Chicago and Champaign-Urbana. Do you know in any way, are they at work in a policy way in Wisconsin at all, or only contained?
I think they have some interest in doing that. That's why we were contacted by a representative of the group. They're looking to see if there's journalists and advocates in Wisconsin who would like to help their efforts to make access to records like these more public.
Bill Leaders, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, our guide to new developments involving open government and access to records. And you can join the conversation. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get up to speed on issues of open records and government transparency and the latest efforts of a statewide group working to protect public access to meetings and records. Join in at any point in the discussion. Call in with a question, share a concern, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bill Leaders is president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and stays with us. Bill, let's turn to the Madison Metropolitan School District. They have agreed to pay $18,000 to settle an open records lawsuit over failure to fulfill a document request from the conservative law firm Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. How effective is the threat of being sued and fined to ensure that records are released?
Well, this is an important case. I'm going to take a break before I answer your questions, because
sure.
I have to issue a rare correction here. We spoke about the invisibility project. It's actually called the Invisible Institute.
The Invisible
is
Institute.
The name of the group that is providing records on use of force complaints in the state of Illinois. With regard to the lawsuit that was brought by Will against the Madison School Department, it is an important case because not only did the district admit that it was wrong, it is paying the attorney fees of the institute for the costs that incurred in suing it, plus punitive damages. I think there's like some $7,500 in actual attorney fees, but they're paying a total of $18,000, which includes punitive damages because of how poorly that they responded to records requests and how long it took for them to provide records. In addition to providing the money, the Madison Metropolitan School District has agreed to clean up its act, to consult with other school districts that have better records in terms of providing access to public records. So they're going to consult with Milwaukee school officials.
That's what I found.
They've agreed to.
I just want to pause there for a moment. In that is according to the law firm that the district has these obligations from this suit. They agreed, as you mentioned, to meet with public records clerks from Milwaukee Public Schools mm-hmm. to find ways to improve how Madison is doing business with records. Does Milwaukee do things differently?
Yeah, I guess it does. I think most school districts have a better record than the Madison Metropolitan School District, which is singularly bad and has been. We had a director of communications there who has left his job under considerable duress, who was possibly or probably responsible for some or much of these delays. The school district has agreed to hire additional staff. There was a problem that it had with having insufficient staff to respond to the volume of records requests that it received. This is a very typical problem for governments at the state and local level to say, hey, we don't have enough staff to handle these requests more promptly. That's why it takes us so long. And to some extent, that's a justifiable excuse, but In other cases, it's just not. The law requires custodians to treat records requests as among the most important obligations that they have as public officials. And so if you don't have enough staff to deal with the volume of requests that you receive, you have to hire more staff. It's just a requirement of the law that you provide the resources necessary, to meet your obligations to the citizens who want records from you.
One of one of those obligations that you mentioned, hiring more staff, including an attorney. How expensive and feasible is compelling the release of records through the courts?
Well, it can be very expensive. If you sue to compel the release of records, it can very easily run to thousands of dollars, even tens of thousands of dollars. If a case gets litigated all the way to the state Supreme Court, you're talking perhaps $100,000 that could be spent in legal fees to fight the case and to try to establish better law in terms of access to records. So, you can recover under Wisconsin statutes if you prevail substantially in the lawsuit that you bring. You can recover your actual attorney fees, but there's no guarantee. And there's been a court decision that was rendered here in Wisconsin, which complicates that matter, which gives records custodians somewhat of an out if they get sued and then they promptly provide the records. There was a Wisconsin Supreme Court case that said, well, now you're no longer entitled to your fees because they gave you the records after all. So even though you spent $7,000 or $8,000 to get them to release the records, you're out that money because they did so. Now, there's an effort in the state legislature, which is supported by Will and has a couple of Democrats, along with a number of Republicans, who are the chief sponsors of this legislation, that would end that ability of local officials to avoid paying the legal fees of requesters who have to sue to get the records they're entitled to.
You mentioned the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Who is most frequently challenging delayed and denied releases of public records?
Well, Will and the former attorney for Will, Tom Kamenick, who runs what's called the Wisconsin Transparency Project, has handled a number of lawsuits involving a number of agencies, including the Madison Police Department, challenging long delays in the providing records in response to requests. So he's done a number of these lawsuits. The problem is that our law is not precise. The open records law says that custodians should provide records, quote, as soon as practicable and without delay, end quote. Well, what does that mean? Is that 10 days? Is it 10 weeks? Is it 10 months? There's never been a
Open
court ruling
to
that's drawn any bright lines.
Yes, it's open to interpretation. Bill Leader is with us, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, as we talk about open government transparency. With your voice, you can join in, call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Bill, last month, an outside law firm investigation found that a spokesperson for the Madison Metropolitan School District had bullied employees and disparaged journalists. Are records withheld more often due to uncooperative people or broader barriers?
Well, in that case, there was a very interesting development, which happens in a number of records cases where the individual who was employed by the school district and who had complaints filed against him, sued the district, sued his own employer to block release of these complaints that had been filed against him. He lost, and the records were provided, and the records showed a couple of batches of them, that there were some very serious allegations that were made. The individual has now left his employment with the Madison School District. But it was a legal fight that was engaged because our law, as a result of a Supreme Court decision a few decades ago, allows public employees to sue to block the release of certain records that concern the reputation and privacy interests. This is sometimes invoked. It always adds to delays to the process. It adds to the cost of everyone involved. It's virtually never successful. In fact, I'm not aware of any situation in which an employee has used this mechanism in the law to successfully block the release of records. It just adds delay and cost to the process, but in the end, they always lose.
Bill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bill Leaders is president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. He is editor at large of the Progressive Magazine. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. An interim director now oversees the state court's office. The four liberal justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court voted to fire Randy Koshnick earlier this month after holding the job for 6 years. We get reaction and examine the work of the chief non-judicial officer of state courts. You can be part of the conversation at any point. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Randy Koshnick is former Wisconsin State Courts Director and Jefferson County Circuit Court Judge. Randy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Nice to be here again.
Good morning. Justice Janet Protasiewicz, now officially a member of the state's high court after being elected in April. She replaced Justice Patience Rokensack, who retired. And the day after Justice Protasiewicz was sworn in, the court votes to remove you from office. What is your reaction to that decision?
Well, my first reaction, Kate, is that the court didn't actually vote. The court is a court of seven. And I would invite your listeners, by the way, to not take my word for what I'm about to say, but to do their own research, primarily Wisconsin Constitution Article 7, which describes the judiciary. Section 4 says it's a court of seven justices, and that the Chief Justice, currently Annette Ziegler, is the administrative head of the entire Wisconsin court system. So I was told by Justice Jill Karofsky during a phone call July 31st that they had enough votes to fire me. They had four votes to fire me. And I was very surprised because the Chief Justice was in New York with me at a conference. She was unaware of any court meeting or conference to discuss this very important issue of whether we should fire the director. I spoke also with Justices Rebecca Bradley and Brian Hagedorn. They were not aware of any consideration of this question that day. So it was not, they were not acting as a court of seven or as a Supreme Court. The liberal justices were acting as a court of four, which is contrary to the Constitution, the state Constitution provisions I just mentioned.
So there wasn't a formal meeting where a vote was taken, a vote was held.
That's correct. What the internal operating procedures call for the Supreme Court, which are developed pursuant to the Constitution of Wisconsin, provide that they have administrative conferences, the court does, where they all attend, either in person or sometimes by Zoom or phone. In any event, all seven justices have the right to be there and to participate and have a discussion for obvious reasons. They might have various opinions about how things something should be handled, and maybe during the course of the discussion, someone changes their mind or brings something that has not been previously considered. And so there was no such administrative conference scheduled in the entire month of August. In fact, their administrative conference schedule and their oral argument schedule runs from September until June each term. So there was no conference. There was no consultation with the three conservative justices before this decision was made. And so this isn't really about me, Kate. The liberals could have legally fired me in September if they asked the chief to put on the agenda for the September administrative meeting, which I think is in early September. All seven justices participate. They discuss the matter. The law provides if I don't have four votes of support, I'm terminated with or without cause. And I knew that heading into the job. So it's not really about me. I'm just very concerned about the state Supreme Court and how these liberal justices, in my opinion, have violated the state constitution at least three times in the first 3 or 4 days in power.
Did your termination letter list any reason for dismissal?
No, it didn't. In fact, when Justice Kurowski called me July 31st, my first question was, after he told me I would be terminated the following day, have I done anything wrong or anything below the level of competence? And she said, no, we're just moving in a different direction. The termination letter just said, thank you for your service, and today is your last day in this position, basically. And, you know, in the 6 years that I had this position, Kate, it's important to mention no justice ever complained about me or to me about anything that I had done in the position. I received an award from the State Bar of Wisconsin in 2020 for the way I kept the courts running through the pandemic. Many state court systems shut down. Wisconsin kept moving. We had to close courthouses because of the pandemic, but I moved very quickly with my CCAP team to have Zoom initiated in all the courts. We used remote appearances, gave the public and media access through YouTube and other forms of video transmission, and kept the courts running. So I received an Innovator of the Year award in 2020. So I think I did a very good job, and I know that judges around the state agree I did a very good job. Many have questioned my dismissal, including your previous guest, Bill Leaders, who I know, he wrote an editorial shortly after I was terminated saying Koshnick was a great advocate of public transparency. He promoted transparency in the courts, and our Supreme Court liberal justices need to provide a reason for why Koshnick was terminated. And they've not done so yet. They're not returning phone calls or email inquiries from the public or from the media. And so that's troubling, Kate, because a judge should have a reason for any decisions that he or she makes. They haven't given anything here. And it should be articulated. You know, when a judge is on the record, makes a decision in court, they're normally required to say, here's what I'm ordering and here's why. So we have neither logic in my termination or any articulation or response, even though there's been multiple inquiries demanding answers.
They have named an interim replacement in the judge, Audrey Skowronski. Has there been any communication on what the job entails or any handoff or materials for the interim?
No, and that's actually the second constitutional violation that the new liberal bloc had their first week on the bench. When your listeners are reading Article 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution, like I said, Section 4 describes it as a court of seven justices, each of whom has a right to be heard and to vote. Each of those seven has been elected by a majority of voters in Wisconsin, and those voters have the right to have their elected justice at the table. Section 10 of Article 7 states that no judge, while serving a term of office, may hold a non-judicial office of public trust. And the Director of State Court's office is a non-judicial office. It's purely administrative. It's public trust office because you're exercising discretion over public funds and public resources. And so when the Supreme Court liberals appointed the interim director the day after I was terminated, that's another violation of the state constitution. And there was no transition. I would have been happy to work with the incoming director. I respect the power of the court to appoint who they choose, but there was no transition. I was notified August 2nd that I'd be done later that day. And as I understand it, the interim was appointed the next day, but no discussion between her and I, no request by the liberal justices for any sort of transition plan or any transition of power. And I assume it's very rocky because it's a very complicated job to run a court system with, you know, over 700 employees, including all the judges and court reporters. And most judges don't have administrative experience. I know for me, it was a steep uphill learning curve when I first took the job in 2017. And I should add, Kate, when I took the job, I finished my final term as a circuit court judge because of that state constitutional provision. So when I interviewed with the Supreme Court, so I was interested in the director's job, and they informed me I would be given the job. We discussed the fact that I would not be able to begin until August 1st, 2017, which was the day after my then existing term in office as a judge would terminate. So I'm very concerned that they've made this illegal move to appoint her.
Because a sitting judge, as you say, cannot take another position in state government outside of being a judge while they're serving their term.
Right. And your listeners can read it. Article 7, Section 10, Wisconsin Constitution.
Talking with former Wisconsin State Courts Director Randy Koshnick with us. You can join in with your questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Troy in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Yes, hello. I would just an observation. I notice you keep saying liberal judge, liberal court, repeatedly in your when you're describing things. And to me, that shows a, you know, maybe that's why we're terminated. I don't know.
Troy, thanks for calling in. Randy, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. I'm using, well, you know, commonly used references. We've only got so much time, Kate. And I think most people refer to the three conservatives and the four liberals in those terms instead of having to list all their names every time. So, and when I say liberal conservative, I mean liberal in their jurisprudence or their view of the Constitution and the law. It's just a quick, easy reference for a relatively short conversation like we're having.
I want to pivot. I want to pivot to the job. How do you describe the responsibilities of the state court's director?
Well, it's non-judicial, it's non-political. It's described in the Supreme Court rules as the chief non-judicial officer of the court system. So what most of your listeners are probably familiar with is the WCCA website, commonly known as CCAP, where you can look up court records on individuals and businesses. I know that small business people use it to check on customers, landlords, tenants. Parents use it to check background of their child's boyfriend or girlfriend sometimes. But that website is just a small section of the statewide IT network, which is the backbone of the court system. So all the court records that the judges use and the clerks use and the lawyers use is contained in the CCAP network. And all the judges and clerks have technology devices in the courtrooms and in their offices that help to process the tens of thousands of cases that go through the system every year. The director also runs the budget and fiscal office, runs HR for all the state court system employees. I oversee the judicial education office, which trains our judges throughout the course of the year to make sure they're up to date on the law, and advises the Supreme Court on matters relating to policy and pending legislation. Finally, I also run the public records request system within the court system that Bill Leaders talked about. So when you send a public records request to an official in the court system, that normally would come through my office for legal analysis and compliance and running a CCAP check and so forth.
Let's bring on a call. Jeff in Delafield now. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. And thanks for taking up this topic. My question is, you know, a lot of comments are made about laws broken at the Supreme Court level. When we feel that the Supreme Court itself is breaking laws, what is our recourse as citizens to hold our Supreme Court accountable other than elections that come up, you know, fairly infrequently? And it's so disappointing to me to hear, you know, how it seems like our, you know, it's just another example how we've sunk to a new low in terms of hyper-partisanship in the state of Wisconsin on both sides. I don't mean to pick on one side or the other, but it just seems like every year we just get more, we just keep sinking deeper and deeper and deeper into this abyss of hyper-partisanship. So the question is, what is the recourse when we feel that the Supreme Court itself is breaking the law?
Jeff, thanks for calling in. Randy.
Well, that's a great question. And one of the problems here, we have a constitutional crisis because these four liberal justices have become a law unto themselves. One more item I'd like your listeners to look at related to this question is on wicourts.gov, which is the state's court system website. The statement of Annette Ziegler, the chief justice, dated August 4th, near the bottom of the page, contains a copy of the liberals' proposal to strip the chief justice of her powers by replacing the phrase chief justice with an administrative committee throughout the internal operating procedures. So there's a big question about whether they can do that. I don't think they can. I think it's an unconstitutional attempt to strip the chief justice of her administrative powers. So we're at sort of a deadlock. And now we actually have sort of two Supreme Courts in Wisconsin. We have the legitimate court, which is all seven justices. And then we have this illegitimate block of four, which is acting independently of the entire group of seven. So some people say, well, can't you go to federal court? No, we can't. There's no federal question here. This is purely state law, state constitution, state justices. So there is no federal question that I see or that most lawyers have talked to see here. So the problem is you keep moving back to the same Supreme Court, and they are the judge and jury of their own actions. So people will say, why don't you sue to get your job back? Well, you know, if I do that, I probably end up in front of the same four who fired me. If we challenge their attempt to strip the Chief Justice of her administrative authority, which is clearly spelled out in the state constitution, these four justices have enough votes to read things into the constitution that's not there. So the direct question is, what power do the people have? So I'm not advocating anything because I'm not trying to be political, but the only legal avenue I'm aware of would be impeachment. So if the people believe that a judge or justice has violated his or her oath or has engaged in corruption, which I think includes violation of an oath and violation of the Constitution, the people can, through the representatives in the assembly, impeach that judge or justice by a majority vote, and the matter then moves to the state Senate where the matter is tried. So the state Senate serves essentially as the court and the jury to determine whether the justice should be impeached. And if a justice is impeached, they're removed from office, and I believe they can be ordered not to hold that same office or any other office of public trust in the future. But that's the legal remedy that the founders of the Wisconsin Constitution put in to protect the people ultimately in maintaining their sovereignty over their government.
Randy Koshnick, former Wisconsin State's Courts Director, as we discuss the change in leadership of overseeing the operation of courts across the state. You can join in the discussion, call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with former Wisconsin State Courts Director Randy Koshnick, who was replaced earlier this month by the new liberal majority of justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We discuss the work of managing the state courts, reporting to the Chief Justice. You can call in with a question, add a comment, 800-642-1234. So, Chief Justice Annette Ziegler, you mentioned earlier, expressed disappointment in your removal from office. How closely did you work with the Supreme Court justices to guide your work?
Well, under the Supreme Court rules, the Director of State Courts reports directly to the Chief Justice. So I was in contact with the Chief Justice on pretty much a daily basis. She's the head of the court system. I am sort of the chief operating officer. I keep the system running. So we would speak daily. Other justices, you know, would call occasionally with questions or request information. I always return those calls and provided that information. I'd also meet with the justices in their conferences from time to time on administrative matters. For example, I was putting together the state court system budget request for the legislature and the governor. It took a long time to put that together, talk to all the different entities in the court system, put together a proposed budget. I went to the Supreme Court, you know, they approve it, and then I take it to the legislature, and along with the Chief Justice, try to convince the legislature and the governor to pass the budget as we've requested it.
Are Wisconsin's courts being adequately funded by state lawmakers who passed a new two-year budget this year?
I think generally, yes. I didn't receive everything I requested. I asked for more money for IT security because the court systems around the country and other government agencies are under constant threat of attack from cyber criminals and ransomware attacks. But the legislature did give me enough to provide adequate protection to the system. They did provide enough for to pay. Our main expense is our personnel. We're about 90% personnel costs, as you might imagine. So, yes, I would say we've been adequately funded by the legislature and the governor.
Wisconsin.
I
was going to say, you know, Wisconsin having over 250 circuit court judges. How is this office interacting with the circuit courts around the state and their impact on them?
Well, there are nine judicial districts in Wisconsin, and each district has a chief judge appointed by the Supreme Court. And I meet with the chief judges typically once a month to discuss ongoing issues out in the circuits around the state. And I convey to the chief judges what the policy preferences are of the court, and the judges relate back to me concerns from the field. We also have administrators in the field, district court administrators who support the court's you know, administratively out in the various counties around the state. So there's a very good method of communication, and that's one of my main responsibilities as director as well, to make sure there's good communication between the users in the field. In fact, the lawyers, litigants, judges, court personnel, and the Supreme Court, and the public and the media. I try to interact well and keep an open flow of communication between all those entities.
Do you see any work as being unfinished because you were forced to leave the role?
Oh, yes. I had a number of projects in the works. The Chief Justice has as one of her highest priorities, developing a mental health system in Wisconsin that allows people with mental health issues who are not dangerous to be treated outside the court system, typically in a community-based treatment program, as opposed to being put in jail as a last resort when they don't really pose a threat to anyone else. And so the Chief Justice and I put together a large mental health summit a few months ago. We invited stakeholders from all over the state to come together to try to develop ideas for how we can divert people struggling with mental health issues before they end up in handcuffs or in court or in a jail cell. I don't know where that stands now. I suspect it's going to probably go by the wayside. The Chief and I have been working on that for a couple of years and developed quite a bit of expertise on that. But I fear that may be lost. I was working on other technological advances for the courts to make sure they stay up to date on the technology, and I'm not sure where that stands either. I've not been consulted about anything since I was terminated. I did want to add, Kate, if I could, on the IOPs, the internal operating procedures that the liberals are trying to strip, you know, the Chief Justice of the authority, those rules and procedures have been in place for 40 years, since 1984, through five different Chief Justices, Heffernan, Day, Abrahamson, Roggensack, and now Chief Justice Ziegler. And we've had shifts before in the power structure of the court, 4-3, 5-2, 3-4. No group of justices has ever tried in those 40 years to strip the Chief Justice of her administrative authority. You know, even when Michael Gableman won in 2008, the power shifted to 4-3 conservative. Justice Abrahamson was the Chief Justice for at least 6 or 7 years after Justice Gableman joined the court. There was a lot of tension and acrimony, but nobody ever thought to try to strip the Chief Justice of her powers out of respect for the state constitution. So this latest attempt by these four liberals is really breathtaking. It's unprecedented, and it does, I think, create a constitutional crisis in Wisconsin.
We have about 30 seconds left. You ran for the state Supreme Court more than a decade ago. Are you considering whether to run again in 2025?
No, right now I'm just really focusing, Kate, on getting the word out. I want the people in Wisconsin to know what's happening in the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. I want them to do their own research, read Article 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution, read Chief Justice Ziegler's statement on August 4th, which is on the wicourts.gov website. Read the rules where the liberal majority is attempting to strip the chief of her administrative powers. Be informed. If you're concerned, contact your courts. First of all, ask these justices to explain their decisions. They're not returning calls or texts, and they have a responsibility, in my opinion, to state a reason for their decision. And they're not doing that, and I'm very concerned.
Randy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
Randy Koshnick is former Wisconsin State Courts Director and Jefferson County Circuit Court Judge. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.